Welcome to Queer Writers of Crime, featuring interviews with renowned LGBTQ authors and up-and-coming talent in mystery, suspense, and thriller novels. I'm your host, Brad Shreve, and Justine is here to give her weekly recommendation. Hi, Justine.
How are you?
I'm doing great, actually. I'm doing very well today. I don't know why. I'm just giddy. I was going to tell you why, and there's nothing special going on in my life. So
really? Even the fact that we're both in California where it's not 17 degrees or below zero?
Well, yeah, but I take that for granted after being here for so long.
Not me.
And I do like to poke fun at my friends back home, but I'll be nice today and not do that. I'll just say, why the hell are you staying there?
Yeah, well, you know, it's a little expensive to live here. Hey, speaking of expensive to live here, how's your Patreon?
Well, you know, we don't have Patreon, but we have Buy Me a Cup of Coffee.
That's right.
Because Patreon locks people in to pay every month.
Right.
So, folks, if you want to help out and help pay for this podcast, all you have to do on the show notes, there's a link that says Buy Me a Cup of Coffee. And you click on that and you can leave us a donation. I'm pretty sure there is an option to make it a rolling monthly donation, but you don't have to do that. I think you can just say, here's some money to help you out.
There you go.
So if you want to do that.
What else is on our website? Isn't there a link to give us a voicemail?
There is a link to give us a voicemail. There is indeed. I'm surprised because I don't think you ever look at the website.
Oh, you never know what I need to find out.
And that link can be used for many things. And we'd love to hear from you folks. One, Justine would like to hear what you think of her book recommendations. She wants to hear.
Yeah, you don't have to talk about whether you like me recommending it. I want to know if they like the book I recommend.
Yeah. Did you like the book? Did you dislike the book? Do you not like a particular theme that she like Justine likes paranormal? You may say, I don't want to hear any more paranormal, or I want to hear more paranormal. So anything you want to say about the book recommendations, Justine would love to hear from you about that.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I now have a link on the website where you can look and see which guests are coming up. They aren't necessarily in order, mm-hmm. but you can look and see what guests are coming up. And if you have a question that you would like me to ask that guest, leave a message and I will do so. I'll make sure it gets on the air. And if you don't want your voice on the air, I'll forgive you. You can send us a message on the contact page, but we'd like to be able to air your voice. That'd be kind of fun.
Yeah.
So people do know that they aren't the only ones listening to our show. There are at least four others.
Right. That's right. Those five people every week. We're showing up.
Sometimes it's a different five.
Oh, who knew?
Couple of people.
Weren't we once like the top listened to show in some Eastern European country?
What was it? I think it was Romania. It was in the top five.
Wow. Yeah.
Book shows. So, mm-hmm. yeah, I don't know what that was all about, but we're a hit in Romania.
That's right. That's right. Okay. So is that all our announcements?
No.
Hey, who's coming next week?
Well, that's what I'm going to tell you. Here's the list of upcoming folks that people can drop and leave a message. So upcoming guests are Jack Dixon, Wendy Heard.
Jack Dixon is a Re-Queer Tales author. We have loved the fact that we have republished his Jazz Anderson series, and he's a lovely person. I think you're really going to enjoy that interview.
Well, our email exchanges have been very nice.
Yeah.
Aside from Jack Dixon, I also have coming up Wendy Heard, J.B. Sanders, Bill Prystock, Marco Coricari. Oh, my God. I need to start talking to these people instead of just emails. And then Michael Nava.
Oh, good. Wonderful. All wonderful.
Yep. So I'll have their names and a few others on the list on the website. So you can go there and just say upcoming guests.
Yeah.
So take advantage of that. That would be fun. I think that's all I have. I don't have any great.
This is all you have? You're.
No, I don't have. Not...
Okay. Then we are on to my recommendation for this week.
All righty.
All right. Well, as you know, it's not just paranormal that I like. It's my number one favorite genre is time travel. But my number two favorite genre is hard-boiled PIs who grunt instead of talking about relationships. And this book falls into that genre. It is that first heady burn It is the first of the Slater Ibanez books. Slater Ibanez is a PI. He's in Los Angeles. He's an insurance investigator most of the time. He does do some bodyguard work, but this book is about one of his insurance investigations. And Slater is a very interesting character. He is Latino, and people occasionally call him derogatory names for being Latino. But his father was Latino and his mother was Jewish, and he really doesn't identify so much as that. But he reacts badly when they say such things. He also reacts badly to almost anything else in his life. He's got a real anger management problem. If he goes up to somebody he's investigating, he'll, you know, punch him out before he even says hello, holds him against the wall, really goes at the world with his fists. And he doesn't come across as very likable, but he's got some very likable qualities. He doesn't sleep with underage boys. He is a vegan. He loves his mother, even though she annoys him. It's just, you know, these quiet good things that he does without thinking much.
He's a hard-boiled detective who's a vegan.
Yep.
Oh, that's awesome. Who drinks too much, of course?
And who definitely drinks too much. And, you know, people ask him how he can be a hard-boiled detective. He says, look, there's a lot of people who I think deserve to be punched in the face, but animals aren't one of them, so I don't eat animals. And that's his basic life philosophy.
That's logical to me.
Sounds logical to me, too.
Though I had a neighbor's dog I thought deserved to be punched in the face. I always have to remind myself, dogs are just being dogs.
Dogs are just being dogs. Yes.
Dogs are just being dogs. I would never punch them in the face, but there, you know, there are certain times that you just like.
you just want to punch somebody in the face, right?
Yeah, so I'll just find a person on the street. They're probably not nearly as nice.
Yeah. So this insurance company has hired him to investigate a workers' comp claim, where he has to stake out the injured to make sure he's really injured, make sure that like his knee is really has torn ligaments. And it turns out that the company the guy works for, he kind of confronts the guy and talks to him. And the guy says there's something at the company, and then he shuts up right away. And this causes Slater to investigate the company. And there's a lot of things that it's not really clear. They've only got 8 employees, but they're making a ton of money. They're investigating. They're importing little controller devices for electronics, and you know they got this big warehouse, and all you see is like a couple of guys standing around the table putting the stuff into boxes, and all of it just does not add up. And the book follows him through the investigation and in a lot of tangents that somehow weave together at the end. And he sorts it out and solves that mystery, even though that wasn't part of his original investigation. Very diligent, very logical. Each clue leads him someplace, but sometimes those are dead ends or they turn out not to be dead ends, but he thinks he's hitting a wall. He has a former lover who's a cop who complains quite a bit about having to help him, but then helps him anyway. The cop was somebody that he really fell for, and then the cop broke it off before it went too far, and he's still kind of stinging from that. And the supporting characters are all good. You got the cop, you got one of the company owner's bodyguards who he gets into a fair amount of tussles in. He goes after him with a shovel, and then there's a gun, and there's just a lot of close-up action where he is involved with weapons on both sides. It is the first in an 11-book series, and he's still writing them.
But he's the type of guy you don't want to fuck around with.
Nope. And it reminds me of a lot of the other hard-boiled detectives. Benjamin Justice, your character Mitch. What is Mitch's last name again?
O'Reilly.
Mitch O'Reilly. Yeah, I should have known that. Sorry. Yes. Sorry, it's a Saturday.
That's okay.
And he also reminds me of Michael Navas' character, who has stopped drinking, of course, but this guy is still drinking. And I'm looking forward to reading more in the series. It's a very quick read. The writing is very staccato. You just kind of keep bouncing along. And he's in L.A.
Oh, I love an L.A. story.
Oh, yeah. Because, you know, if they're not driving up to 110 and hitting traffic all times of the day, you know, it's not, you know, it's really L.A.
2 hours just to get downtown.
Yes.
But I can actually get downtown in 30 minutes at 2 in the morning.
He can get downtown in 30 minutes, or he can get most places as long as he knows all the back roads and the streets that are not crowded that he can speed along. And he manages to get most of the places he wants to get to pretty quickly. But everybody else gets stuck in traffic. I'm giving it intriguing recommendations.
Intriguing.
That's the category where all the twisty little mysteries with lots of clues fall into place. And I don't think I could have been able to guess the ending. I try very hard not to guess the ending because that's just how I enjoy mysteries. But I think if I was looking to guess the ending, I would not have guessed it.
But you had all the clues.
I did.
He played fair.
He did play fair. He played very fair. And you're looking and go, oh, that should have been obvious. It's not a murder mystery. It's just a crime that I think you'll find fascinating.
And I don't know why I was thinking about this, but when you describe him, he reminds me of Perry Mason.
Well, Perry was a lawyer, but, you know, in the original books, I think he was an insurance investigator for a while.
No, HBO got it. Is it HBO or Netflix that did the Perry Mason series?
I think it was HBO.
Okay. They kind of sort of based it on the original Perry Mason novels, but not entirely. Perry Mason from day one was an attorney. And in book number two, Della was his secretary. He wasn't, you know, in the movie, she's somebody else's secretary. So in that sense, the movie got it wrong. But in the early 30s novels of Perry Mason, he would kick ass and he had no problems planting clues to solve his case.
Oh, dear. That's not something I... Certainly not this guy doesn't ever plant clues.
No. But I just felt the need to bring it up that Perry Mason was not all squeaky clean in the beginning. But the author became more conservative as time went on. And of course, then once you got on television, you had to clean up the act.
That's right.
So they put a gay man in the role.
A squeaky clean gay man.
Yes, exactly. So any authors out there, if you really want to make Justine happy, write a hard-boiled, time-traveling, paranormal detective.
Yeah, I think I really would like to see that. The time travels all tend to be, they have some romance, and a lot of them have very, very good mysteries, though. But boy, I'd love to see one of these guys time travel and see his reaction to time travel. Like, you know, if he can't deal with the relationships, I don't know how he's going to deal with the time jump.
You would get along with my husband. He's totally into time travel and he especially loves alternate universes.
Yep. So overall, it's an intriguing recommendation and I think people should pick it up. And the series is well known within the genre. If you've heard of it and haven't tried it, go ahead. If you haven't heard of it, this is your introduction.
And it's the first Hetty Byrne by George Bixley.
That's right.
All right. So all we've got for this week?
That's all we got.
Okay, folks, check the website to see who's coming so you can leave a question for upcoming guests.
Okay. See you next week, Brad.
If you enjoyed Queer Writers of Crime, let others know by leaving a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you hear our show. Liza Lenski is the author of lesbian fiction and romance novels, including the best-selling Winter Jacket and Don't Call Me Hero series. Although a historian by day, Liza is passionate about fiction. She lives in Boston, Massachusetts with her wife and their cat, Charlie. Although currently in New England, Liza is a Midwest transplant. Midwest is often the backdrop of her stories. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Brad.
It's wonderful to have you on. So you have a PhD in American history, both 19th and 20th century. I'm curious, what does an historian do? Because I can think of many things.
Well, historians, primarily if you get your doctorate, you become a college professor, or you can also kind of plan B is work in public history. So public history, things like museums, historic preservation, libraries, and really that's where most people interact with history is outside of a classroom. So public history. And I mean, when you live in New England, you can't throw a stone without hitting some kind of historic site. So I'm really happy to be in this place right now, although I love the Midwest and I plan someday to go back. Right now, it's really great to be in New England.
Well, I was right on both counts. I figured it was one or the other. May I ask which one you do?
I prefer not to say.
Okay. We will leave that as is.
It's part of my mystique.
Okay, that's quite all right. No problem there. So you live in Boston, which, as you said, you would never run out of things. The first time I went to Boston, I walked the Freedom Trail, which, because Boston's a very small city, mm-hmm. very much like San Francisco. And I was just bowled over, not just from the sights on the Freedom Trail, but in general. In California, if something was built in 1920, we put a historical landmark on it.
It's true.
Much different in Boston.
You could say the same thing with the Midwest, too. You think of an old building maybe as Civil War era. And then over here, I mean, the Salem Witch Trial, 1692. I live just a stone's throw from Salem. So it's really, I don't know, surreal to walk around and you see cobblestone streets. But I mean, when you're in Europe, I mean, that's, you can go to the Colosseum. So we're babies.
Yeah. Yeah. So how much are you able to, I presume quite a bit, how much are you able to integrate what you've learned from history or your research abilities, I'm losing my voice, into your stories?
Yeah, it's, I mean, I've been tempted to write works of historic fiction, and probably, I mean, I would never say never, but right now all my stories tend to be contemporary, but the research, I think, is where I really shine, because we always say as authors, write what you know, but if you're able to research, you're able to learn more. And so that wheelhouse gets bigger and bigger. So I am a voracious researcher. I want to get it right, especially if it's something that doesn't come to me naturally or is outside my realm of comfort. And I would say if you read any of my books, you will be entrenched in the details of some, maybe too much, but you know, just like my most recent book, is one of my main characters is a airline attendant, and so I had to learn everything about what it was like, what it's like to be in the, you know, that kind of profession, because that's not something that I know how to do.
Yeah, that's the woman in 3B.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, that's your most recent romance novel, correct?
Correct.
Okay, we're going to get to that one.
Okay.
So you identify primarily as a romance author, but you also say that you like police procedurals and detective stories. What attracts you to mystery?
I think, I mean, like probably most writers, I read so much when I was young, and I just felt really naturally compelled, really drawn to mysteries. And I think I cut my teeth probably on the Encyclopedia Brown books, you know, like the 60-second, 90-second mysteries. And even after that, it was all just this steady diet of Nancy Drew and the Hardy Boys. And then after that, I got really into the Robin Cook's books, these kind of like biological medical mysteries, and then Sue Grafton with her ABC series. So it just was a kind of a genre that I love to read, because you have to figure things out along the way. And even today, my wife hates this, but I can figure out when I watch a movie, I'll like kind of like grab onto her hand and say, I know how this is going to end. And I'm usually right. So I just love the active thinking that goes into it. You're not a passive participant in mystery. And I love figuring out the mystery along with the detective or the police officer.
What's the difference in your writing between romance and history or mystery?
A lot more plot. Mm-hmm. the characters, the love story is still really important, because that's what my readers expect of me, is to have two strong female characters and they're going to fall in love along the way. But the plot lines, there's a lot less of that interaction between the two characters. And instead, it's really about, at least in Don't Call Me Hero, it's all about Cassidy Miller and the relationships that she has outside of her love interest, Julia. And so that plot device, I think, is a lot more salient than in some of the others, which can be more uncomplicated, just kind of hallmarky love stories.
Well, it's funny to me that you mentioned Sue Grafton, who I'm a big fan, and it's a great series of books. But I'm surprised that you feel inspired by her, because the one thing Kinsey Millhone, her protagonist, did not have was any kind of romantic life.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
What?
At least not one that carries over from book to book to book. You know, there'll be like a you know, a guy here or there that she falls into bed with. But you're right. Yeah, there's not like really steady relationships throughout the series.
Well, the series actually takes place in a very short amount of time. I think she said it's like 2.5 years, mm-hmm. even though she wrote the series for decades. I guess in her short period of her life, that's okay. I just found that funny that she inspires you in that sense. So let's talk about your mystery thriller series. Don't Call Me a Hero was the first one of the series?
Yes.
And that's what they call the series in general?
Mm-hmm.
You've written 4 of those, I believe.
Right. And I'm currently working on the 5th book.
And who's the protagonist in that? You just mentioned it briefly.
So the protagonist, her name is Cassidy Miller. And I mean, to go back a little bit to Kinsey Millhone, I just was really drawn to that character because I think at the time I really hadn't thought about female detectives or women in those kinds of positions. I come from a law enforcement background. Well, I don't, but my family does. And I don't think I knew really a single female police officer in my small town, whether that be county or city or state police. So it was really, maybe I was just thirsty for some kind of role model or someone that was in a position of authority or a position of power who had a lot of agency. And so for me, Kinsey Millhone was really attractive in that way. When I'm reading these books, I don't know, I'm like in 8th grade or something. But for Cassidy, she is a deeply flawed character, which is something that I love. And I love in all of my writing, my characters, I think, have some major flaws. And those tend to be the obstacles that get in the way of any kind of relationship. But Cassidy was a Marine. She served two tours in Afghanistan. And then after she left the military, she went into police. So she's a Minneapolis police officer. And it's then when the bad dreams start happening, the flashbacks start happening, she is triggered by your typical kind of PTSD things and decides then that she can't sit behind a desk for the rest of her life, but she also doesn't feel comfortable being active duty in Minneapolis. So she takes an opportunity to be a police officer in this sleepy little small town up in way northern Minnesota.
And I believe the town is Embarrass, Minnesota?
Embarrass, Minnesota, which is a real place.
Oh, it's a real place. I was going to ask you how you came up with that name.
No, I looked at a map and I said, all right, what's Cassidy drives a motorcycle, a Harley Sportster. And I said, what's a reasonable drive? And just looking at it, I said, Embarrass. That's kind of a funny little town. And I did a lot of research on the town. Its motto is the cold spot. And I don't know, it just something about that place. Just I've never been to Embarrass. I'm not sure if people in Embarrass probably don't even know I exist, but it just felt like the right setting for this book.
Well, I am so intrigued. I'm going to have to look it up because I want to know what the founders were embarrassed about.
I actually did a little bit of research on that, and it actually, gosh, I'm not going to be able to pull it off the top of my head right now. But it has something to do with the French fur traders that settled there. So there wasn't like a Mr. Embarrass. It was like the name that these French fur traders gave to a twisty, turny river. But I can't remember. It's something, some kind of French translation.
Oh, see, I was thinking somebody being embarrassed was a much better story. But well,
No. That's fun.
How has Cassidy progressed from book 1 to 4?
Wow. In so many ways, I think she has embraced this idea that that having PTSD is part of her now, that she's not going to be the way that she was before. And I think she's come to terms with the fact that that's okay. And that this isn't something that she has to hide from people anymore, and that she can let her guard down around people when it comes to this thing in her past. In the very beginning of when we first meet her, very few people know about her PTSD. And when she moves to Embarrass, nobody knows about it. And she's very guarded about this. It's something she's hypersensitive, even embarrassed about. And now I think she's welcoming more people into her circle, into her world, and will let people know that about her, at least is less sensitive about that.
And how is the romance affected by her PTSD in the beginning and her progression?
At first, it's kind of like with all the other people in her life. She doesn't want to acknowledge that this thing exists. She doesn't want to admit that she's a flawed person or that she has these limitations or these shortcomings. And so she tries to hide it from Julia for the longest time until she inadvertently sleeps over one night and has a nightmare. And we discover then that Julia actually had a younger brother who also was in the military. And so she saw that, and he unfortunately took his life after he came back from his one tour in Afghanistan. And so Julia sees that same haunted look in Cassidy's eyes when she wakes up, and she recognizes that. And so I think having that shared past is something that really brings them together. And Julia stumbles along the way where she tries to fix Cassidy. She does a lot of research about and tries to get her into certain kinds of therapy and certain experimental procedures. And Cassidy kind of has to say, it's okay. Like, I'm okay. This is just who I am now. So they both have had, I think, to accept the fact that she has PTSD and that's okay.
My protagonist in my novels served in Afghanistan twice and came back with PTSD. And like you, I did a lot of research on PTSD, talked to some former military that have PTSD. That was very difficult. A lot of them didn't want to talk about details. Mm-hmm. So much of the information that I got was really sad. The number who did come home and ended up killing themselves. It was shocking to learn about that because you don't hear about that. Mm-hmm. And I always wonder, you never hear about the other wars. I remember hearing the folks coming back from Vietnam having to deal with their own struggle. But before that, like World War II, you may know the answer to that. You never hear it mentioned. Everybody just came home and all of a sudden moved to the suburbs and everything was hunky-dory after that. Do you know how realistic that is, or were they having the same struggles?
They were having the same struggles. They just had a different language for it. And even as far back as World War I, they would have referred to soldiers having being shell-shocked. Mm. And so the language, I think, has changed, but the sentiment really remain the same. And I love old movies. And there's a really fantastic film called The Best Years of Our Lives, 1946. And it actually won a ton of awards. But it it's one of those movies where there's small stories within, and all of these characters, you're not quite sure how they're connected, but you find those connections by the time the film ends. And one of the characters, well, there's a soldier, a returning veteran, who lost both of his hands in the war, and he struggles with the acceptance that his fiance gives him right away. And he can't even hug her because he feels like he's a monster. And he actually was a soldier turned actor. And then there's another individual who struggles to find work, who has just a lot of anger, a lot of resentment about, I went and I fought this war and I came back and the rest of the world just continued on while I was, as if, you know, this war wasn't happening. So you see, I think even in pop culture, I know that kind of in the 70s and the 80s, the Vietnam vet really loomed large we got Rambo, right? but if you look hard enough, you'll find those crumbs, I think, those little windows, even for World War II.
I would presume it wasn't, even though they referred to it as shell-shocked, which I've always heard, and I never made the connection that is what we call PTSD. I would presume it wasn't nearly as acceptable by the general society. Mm-hmm. Is that true? Can you elaborate on that at all?
Yeah, I think so. And as the generations have come and gone, I think that there's a lot more today compared to World War II era, a lot more willingness to have those conversations. I think about Tim O'Brien's books about the Vietnam War, his historic fiction. and particularly the things they carried. And there's a character, Norman Bowker, who actually ends up committing suicide. And it's such a powerful book. And all of the characters are dealing with the ghosts that still haunt them, the things that they had, that they saw, that they did, the guilt that they come back, that they return with. And so the things they carried ends up being this metaphor for not just the physical things that they carried, that they hoofed around Vietnam, but that the burden, the guilt, the shame that followed them back as well.
Yeah, I have bipolar disorder, and my mom was mentally ill. I don't know what she was ever diagnosed with. My guess is it was also bipolar disorder. And that was in the 60s and 70s, where pretty much they just filled you up with Valium and let you go. And it was something you would never discuss with anyone else. And certainly the family members would never discuss it. And I come from an environment like now, it is who I am. And you know, I wrote a blog about it for 10 years, and I was even interviewed a couple of times by Sanjay Gupta, and I have nothing to hide. It's just like if I had diabetes. So that was a good change. I'm happy to see that changed. And I have always been curious as how it was related to in the past, because you did never hear about it. Mm-hmm. I didn't know.
Yeah, I think it's just a stiff upper lip, buck up, rub some dirt in it, you know, and just move on.
You came from the Midwest, and it's very much still in the Midwest, I believe, much more so. In California, if you don't have a therapist, people think there's something wrong with you. And I had both a psychiatrist and a psychologist tell me they hate it when somebody from the Midwest walks in their door because they know they're going to get a battle that they don't have a problem. And I should just be able to, they don't get support from the family as much because they should just shake it off. You know, we all get depressed from time to time is the response. So still a lot of learning to do, but we've come a long way.
Yeah. That's funny that you bring up the Midwest, and, you know, all of my characters focus so much on being Midwest nice or Minnesota. And a lot of my characters, a lot of my books take place in Minnesota, because when I first started writing, I was too nervous to write about Michigan, where I grew up, because I was worried someone would discover who I was. So I put everything in Minnesota, and now I'm kind of moving back to Michigan. But another, as you mentioned, like another characteristic, I think, of Midwest folk is just being really guarded and putting on that facade of that everything's okay.
Yeah. That's definitely the way my dad was. And he was born and raised in Michigan. In fact, I was born in Michigan. I was in the Lower Peninsula, almost just across the Indiana line. Spent the first 10 years of my life there. And I have some great memories of lots of snow fights and sledding. Lots of things that I'm glad I'm away from nowadays. It's a lot different to play in it than to live in it. But you lived up in the Upper Peninsula.
Yeah.
Which you don't meet, it's not very populated. You don't meet many people that are from the Upper Peninsula.
Yeah. I mean, it's so small. There's only one area code, the entire 906.
And what's funny is many folks in the Upper Peninsula have tried to break away from Michigan and create their own state, which is really funny because it would be an awfully tiny state. A population
wise. States out here, you know, in New England, we've got tiny, tiny states too. So,
yeah, but I think they have a bigger population.
Probably. I always say there is more, more trees than people in the Upper Peninsula. And that's the way they like it.
Yeah. I've never gotten up there. I've always wanted to. It looks incredibly beautiful. Because we lived in southern Michigan, our big outings were always to Chicago. But I would have liked to have seen more of the state, and probably will someday.
Now, it's not going anywhere.
It's not going anywhere. And Michigan, the Upper Peninsula, what most people know of it is Mackinac Island. I can't think of the name of the movie that had Christopher Reeve in it.
Somewhere in Time.
Yes. I don't think I've watched that. My husband has tried to get me to watch it 100 times. And it's not that I'm avoiding it. It's just, I'm not in the mood for that today. But people love that film.
I've never seen it either. And I feel like maybe because it's the calling card of Mackinac Island, I'm not sure. I resisted it, you know, Teenage Rebellion. I probably should sit down and watch that, though.
Yeah, it was great publicity for the island, I'm sure.
Yeah. They, at the Grand Hotel. They built the pool at the Grand Hotel just specifically for that film. Just a little nerdy trivia for you.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, since you haven't seen it and I haven't seen it, maybe we should do a watch party one day.
Yeah.
Back to the first novel, Don't Call Me Hero. You said a lot of that was based on, despite your research, a lot of that was based on your personal information, I guess, growing up in a military family. Can you share what specifically you were able to use from that in the novel?
A lot of, so my dad was the chief of police in my hometown, and then my uncles fought in Vietnam. Even my mom worked on the 911 side of things. So there's the mystery in Don't Call Me Hero is a very, I would say it's a nerdy kind of mystery because there's a lot of paperwork. It's a lot of procedurally kinds of things. And I, in fact, I sat down once with my mom and basically interviewed her about the paperwork and the procedure work for communications and for radios and just a lot of technical kinds of things. So those kinds of details came from my family. But just knowing just simple things like the squeak of a gun belt when you walk, or the heaviness of boots, police issued boots, and the smell of a cop car. I'm sure most people don't have fond memories when they think about the smell of a cop car. But for me, I mean, that's how my dad drove us around. And so that was just like the family car was his squad car. So those kinds of details, just the more kind of emotional connections are things that I really drew from, but also just what it's like to be a cop in a small town where there's not a lot of murder or, you know, kind of exciting crimes, you might think, except for some domestic violence and domestic fights and drug use and alcohol abuse and things like that. So there's little vignettes that are very much drawn from experiences that my dad told me about or remember from my childhood.
That was a wealth of information that you were able to get from them. I have a friend who was a detective for the police department and retired and became a private eye. And you better believe I sucked everything I could get, every bit of information I could get from him, to the point where halfway through the AIDS walk, he was just like, it's fiction. Will you just get over it and just write your book? Because the whole time I'm quizzing him as we're walking down the street.
Yeah, at some point you just got to sit down and write.
Now, how much information was needed that you had to research for the additional novels?
For the after Don't Call Me Hero?
Yes.
I think the biggest piece that I really did research for was learning more about PTSD, treatments, symptoms, triggers, but then also just a lot of what it's like to be a woman in the military. As I mentioned, I didn't know any women in those positions growing up and so didn't have that to draw from. So I read a lot of memoirs, a lot of firsthand accounts about what it was like to be a woman in the military or a woman in the Marines specifically, or even what it's like in the police force. But in the later books, Cassidy, spoiler alert, makes the transition to Cold Case. And so the first book is very different because it's all about being a police officer in a small town. But she's going to make the shift to Cold Case, to be a Cold Case detective in really the rest of the series. Because after I wrote Don't Call Me Hero, and it was always intended just to be a standalone, but folks really were drawn to it. And I just felt like I had so much more story to tell. And I always had wanted to write a series of this kind. And so here it was finally happening. So I had to, I actually couldn't stay in that small town all the time because I'd run out of things to do, right? We can't all just be Angela Fletcher there, but or Jessica Fletcher. So she made the switch over to Cold Case. So I had to do a lot of research about just Cold Case procedural kinds of things.
I'm curious, you have a PhD in 19th and 20th century American history. Is there a particular part of that history, maybe it's military, that really attracts you or you find yourself more focused on?
I don't do military history at all. I don't do I'm a cultural historian. So it's all about what people think and what people thought and their values and their beliefs and why they purchased this and not that and why they watched this movie and not that. So it's totally different from what I do in my day job. And maybe that's part of the reason why it's so nice, because I am somebody else when I'm writing these books versus what I do during the day.
Have you done any consulting work for other authors? I see so many novels that have history just wrong. And usually it's a little thing that you don't even think about that we do in our everyday that just didn't exist 100 years ago.
Oh, sure. Anachronisms. Yeah.
Oh, it drives me crazy. Have you been able to help anybody in any way or consider that as something to do? Could be a sideline?
If people want some historical help, I'm more than happy to do that. I haven't at this point done any kind of consulting, but I always had this when I was young and I knew that I liked history and was just thinking about what can I do with a history major. In fact, my parents always teased me that the shortest book ever written was Job Opportunities for History Majors. But but I always wanted to be a consultant for the movies. I love movies. And particularly when you grow up in a small town and there's not a whole lot to do, my family, we would spend every weekend at the movies. Sometimes Friday and Saturday night, we would go and see a different movie. And that escapism was really important for me growing up queer, I think, in a small town, but also and being immersed in different worlds. But I always imagined that I could use my history degree to help people make correct historical films.
Well, back to your youth, I was a huge fan of Encyclopedia Brown. I think I read every book. And I was always so frustrated when I didn't solve the crime, which was most of the time. Mm. And it's so funny now, I've gone back and read them a few times and it's so obvious. but they definitely had an influence on me as well. They were fun reads.
Yeah. I remember one that sticks out in my brain is there was some kind of like eating contest that these people had to eat something disgusting without making a face. But it was like a weird biathlon or something where they had to run and then they had to eat something nasty. And one of the runners was eating ice chips before the eating portion, and Encyclopedia Brown was kind of like, haha, I know why he didn't make a face. It's because he had those ice chips and it numbed his tongue. And so he couldn't taste that lemon lime thing. I don't know why that stuck with me, but it did.
The one that sticks with me, which is very odd, I don't remember what the point of the plot was. It involved whale vomit.
Oh, wow.
who was the antagonist in the series? Do you remember his?
No, I don't.
The bully. I can't remember his name either. Yeah. But, you know, he was always involved.
Whale vomit.
Yeah. And, of course, the famous one was when somebody had a coin that was labeled 10 BC. That one I got. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That was a give me. So most of your fans are romance fans. And as we said, you're primarily a romance writer. I was looking through your books, and it looks like there is a progression from there's a mystery thriller aspect throughout them. But as the series progresses, and I hope I'm not giving too much away, Cassidy's relationship becomes a little more settled.
Yeah.
And I saw some interesting comments from people in the later novels that how disappointed they were that you had the nerve. Those are my words, not theirs, but it was implied. You had the nerve to focus on the plot rather than the romance.
How dare I?
Who do you think you are?
Yeah. My readers, they love Julia Desjardins, the love interest, so much. And I mean, she's such a great character. So I know that they want more Julia all the time. And they will be, I think, happy with book 5, which is the book I'm working on right now, because it's all Cassidy and Julia dealing with the death of her father, Julia's father. They're back in Embarrass. They are settling the arrangements for the funeral and the wake and things like that. So there's not the cold case to get in the way, but there is going to be some kind of mystery that needs to be solved.
So you redeem yourself and still have a good mystery this time.
I mean, I hope so. I hope so.
Well, I also know that you like Happily Ever Afters. And that's true. I presume they're pretty much guaranteed in your novels.
That's true.
Have you ever considered shaking things up a bit?
You know what? I did once. I have a book called Fragmented.
Mm-hmm.
And it has two endings. One is a open-ended, what's going to happen next? Oh, no, we were wrong the whole time kind of ending. And the other one has a very tidy, happy ending. I resist, I think, unhappy endings, unsatisfying endings, because we have so few happy endings in the real world. Mm-hmm. And even in, again, I'm a big movie fan, and I've probably watched every single lesbian film ever created. Even if there's just like the slightest longing glance, I am, you know, I've seen this film 20 times, and I'm always greatly disappointed that by the end of these movies, someone goes crazy or dies or is straight and the relationship doesn't work anymore. So until I think more, and I will say, I think that we've done a lot better at this in television than in film, but until film kind of figures this out and gives us the happy endings we've been demanding, I'm going to keep writing happy endings.
And I think right now is a time when people need happy endings. For certainly sure. Over the last year, it's interesting that during World War II is when all the grand musicals came out in the movie mm-hmm. theaters, and they were mm-hmm. very popular because people needed that escape from what was going on. And so I think that's why so many enjoy a Happily Ever After. In most romances, you're expected to get one. In most, every mystery has a Happily Ever After in the sense that the crime is solved. You know that's going to happen.
Right.
But also in the background, if there's a secondary story or secondary arc, we tend to always have those be happy endings as well. Mm-hmm. I think it's just
it's satisfying. It is what we crave right now. And in fact, I really had a hard time writing in 2020. Working from home, I thought I was going to have so much more time to write, but I just didn't have the mental space to do that because it just felt like the world was on fire. And when there's just disaster everywhere you turn, it's hard to switch gears and just write about happy stuff, even though that's like the moment when we need it the most. And I was, and still am, just guilty of doom scrolling forever. And so that got in the way, I think, of me being more productive, but I'm hopeful things are looking up maybe. I really am trying to rededicate myself to writing more in 2021.
And this has come up quite a bit in the show from other authors. I was one of those that thought, okay, this pandemic is horrible, but it's going to give me the freedom because I don't have anything else to do to write. Mm-hmm. And most writers I know, some succeeded in that, but most writers I know were like you and I, where there was just such this heaviness in the world that it did make it harder rather than easier to write. Mm-hmm. So a little angst in life is good to become a writer, but maybe not too much.
Yeah, you got to find a balance there.
And it's funny, I'm going to go back to something you said earlier, that you're always here to write what you know. And I find that term interesting. It's definitely true in the beginning when somebody starts as a writer. Mm-hmm. But if you only write what you know, you're not going to have very many books out. So I think it's overused in the sense that as a long-term rule, it's a good thing. It's also not necessarily always that interesting. As you said, I'm sure you dig up lots of information that you didn't plan to put into a book but came across that mm-hmm. was just so interesting. Was there anything in particular that stands out that you found most surprising or learned in your research?
That's a good question. I don't know if there's anything necessarily surprising. I guess I working. So there's a lot of flashbacks in the Don't Call Me Hero series, and I demark them by, I write in the past tense, but the flashbacks are present tense just to have some kind of disequilibrium for the reader and to note that we're doing something else now. And that part, just trying to get into the mindset of someone who is on the battlefield, who is dealing with just death and trauma all around them, that just took so much research, because it's hard. We don't naturally put ourselves in that position. And you can watch as many military movies as possible, but I think until you actually read the memoirs of people who that was their lived experience, I don't think you can really do justice to it. And when I first wrote Don't Call Me Hero, that was probably the biggest piece that I was most nervous about and wanted to get right. Because you can read and research as much as you want, but if the feeling isn't there, it's just a regurgitation of facts and trivia. So it was really important that I get it right. And I was, every time some former soldier, former Marine reaches out to me and says, I was so happy to read this book and it resonated with me, that is probably one of the most rewarding things about writing this particular series.
You chose not to go the traditionally published route and be an indie author. Mm-hmm. And I read that you consider yourself fiercely proud of that. Why is that?
I am. What does that mean? I'm fiercely proud of that. Number one, I love being an independent writer because I have control over everything that I do. I have the last say on everything. And in the work that I do as a historian, that's not true. That's not always the case, right? I don't have the final say on certain things, on most things. And so that for me is really rewarding, but it's also just, it takes so much work to do your own editing, to do your own, I have my own publication, cover art and website design and managing my social media accounts and any kind of PR, that's all on me. So it's a lot of work. It's very time consuming. I've just kind of started doing audiobooks as well. I don't do the narration. I hired professionals to do that, but I had to dig to find the right voices, the right women to carry the load to do this work for me. So even that, when you have a proper publisher, they're the ones that are making those decisions and are seeking out these narrators for you. So I'm just proud of the fact that I feel like I've kind of made it, even without that more traditional apparatus. I feel really good about where I am and how popular my books have become. And it's not because of it, and I can just say it's all because of hard work, you know, and just this determination to do this thing, as opposed to just saying, I wrote this book and I put it in somebody else's hands. And so that's something I'm really proud of, is just how far I've come from book one now to, I don't know, book 15, book 16, something like that. And what a dedicated readership I've been able to organically create.
And speaking of that, I was looking through your books, and one of your romances, the most recent one, The Woman in 3B, mm-hmm. seems to have connected with your readers more so than your other novels. It certainly got a lot more responses. Why do you think that may be?
When I started writing The Woman in 3B, this was intended to be just this really light, easy, Hallmark-esque kind of movie where there's a flight attendant who falls in love unintentionally with one of the passengers, but there's this contest, that this bingo contest that she's trying to accomplish because she's got all of the student debt. And as she's trying to accomplish this bingo task of things like dump water on a passenger or do all of the announcements in a funny accent, she falls in love with this woman, Anissa. And when and I will say this book is set in Michigan. So I finally got brave enough to do Michigan, although it's Detroit, it's still not in the Upper Peninsula. I think that because there is this piece of social justice, Anissa is Middle Eastern, but she's American, but of Middle Eastern descent. Lebanese, the timing, for better or for worse, was right. And when Anissa gets this really ugly racism thrown in her way, they go to a Detroit Tigers game, and when Alice, who's the protagonist, goes to get another round of beers or hot dogs or something, she comes back and Anissa isn't in her seat, and she instead has gone to the women's bathroom just to have a moment and kind of collect herself, because the people in the stands were yelling at her, like, you know, go back to your own country and we don't want your kind here and things like that. And so I think that piece is the first time that I've really dealt with racism in any of my novels, and in such an explicit way. The Final Rose has some microaggressions in it, but I think that really spoke to people and made the book more important than just this fluffy Hallmark throwaway romance.
We are reaching the end of the show. So what we do at the end, your final question, is awkward questions authors get. Uh-oh. And I've surveyed dozens of authors about strange or awkward or difficult questions that they've gotten in the past. And we'll draw one for you. So if you'll hold still, we're going to spin the wheel. Okay, you ready to hear your question?
Bring it on.
Which of the books you've written is your favorite?
I'm going to say Winter Jacket. And here's my justification. Winter Jacket is the first book that really took off. It's my third full novel. And it's the first book that I wrote where I saw an unhappy ending, and I decided I'm going to rewrite that and make it a happy ending. So the trope is professor and student. And I had just finished watching this film, Bloomingdale, but it's a love story between a professor and a student. And the professor ends up losing her job and being ridiculed, and then the student gets away scot-free. Or you could always point to the film Loving Annabelle, where the teacher gets punished and the student gets away scot-free. And so I said to myself, why can't this just work out, right? We've got two consenting adults. As long as there's not a conflict of interest with the grades, like, I'm going to write a story that has a happy ending. And it was the first book, like I said, that just really took off. And that became a series. Again, I never intended it to become a series, but it was so popular. And so there's five books in that series. And so I think just because that's almost like the origin story for Eliza Lenski, I think that's why I'm so drawn to that particular series.
You are not the first author on this show to say they wrote a standalone novel that ended up becoming a series. It's been great chatting with you.
Yeah, thanks.
I appreciate you being on the show.
I appreciate the invite, Brad.
Be sure to subscribe to Queer Writers of Crime wherever you hear our show. Tell a friend, too. Thank you for listening.